Good morning. So, according to the story of Buddha's life, when he was 9 or 10 years old, he was at a plowing festival, and he was sitting there with his royal family, sitting under, I am told, I've been told recently, a rose apple tree, and his mind stopped. His mind stopped. And for a moment or two, there was just watching. There was watching the elephants. There was watching the parasols. There was watching the beautiful costumes that people had on. And he experienced a deep joy, a joy that was not of time, according to the story. It's all we have is stories, right? And then according to the story, when he was 28 years old and he got out of that kingdom to see the real world, he saw people who were old and decrepit. He saw people who were sick and being eaten away by diseases. He saw bodies burning on the funeral pyre. And then he saw a sannyasin. He saw an orange-robed man who seemed to have that same joy that he'd experienced when he was 10, which is not of time, and which just comes up. And he had that memory, and that set him out on the path. Those four set him out. But the fourth was crucial, because if he hadn't had the fourth, I don't know what he would have done. Probably would have just gone and said, oh, screw this, you know. I'm just going to lose myself in alcohol and drugs, probably, or something, whatever the equivalent was at the time, right? So then, supposedly, according to the story, after he had been practicing his practice to try to rediscover this joy for 4 or 5 years, he came to a dead end, and he was really having an awful time, and he just happened to have that emotional memory. It just came in. You know the way emotional memories, positive ones, come in too, right? It just came in. He just remembered what he'd experienced when he was 10. And so he just came back to his breathing. He came back to his posture. He came back to his practice. So then he had his great awakening, and he taught. And what did he teach? He taught about a path. A path from what? A path from dissatisfaction to joy. A path from dukkha to sukha. From dukkha to sukha. That's what he taught about. So, as Buddhist practitioners, we have the possibility to become experts on one thing, only one thing, happiness. Happiness. You may think this practice is austere or yucky, or you have to discipline yourself. You do. It's austere and yucky, and you have to discipline yourself. To what? To become an expert on happiness. Really? That's what this is about. That's what this is about. Thoreau said, and Thoreau disciplined himself, right? I mean, he didn't discipline himself like hitting himself. He just really simplified. He led a meditative life. He led a meditative life. He said, surely joy is the condition of life. Surely joy is the condition of life. Surely it is. So, practice in Mahayana Buddhism is to unravel or remove the concealers of joy. The Buddha nature, our joyous nature, our still open nature, is concealed by a lot of stuff. And our practice is to remove that stuff or let that stuff fall away. And so there's external stuff and internal stuff. conceals, that covers up, that smothers that natural joy that's here. It's always here. So today I will talk then about some of the things that smother up that joy and how to deal with them, which is not a new theme for me because this is what we're doing. This is what this is all about. So in the 21st century, we have concealers of joy that are unique to our environment. We're not living in Buddha's time. We're not living in Katagiri Roshi's time. We're not living in Suzuki Roshi's time. We have our own concealers, and we think, oh, our concealers are worse, but they're just a product of our culture and our internal thinking. So what about external concealers? One, fast-paced society. Quite a bit faster paced than for Buddha. Quite a bit faster pace than for Suzuki Roshi in Japan. Quite a bit faster pace. Fast pace. Well, that's something to pay attention to. Computers, iPods, cell phones, all these things that are... I just have to learn the new names when they come up. All of this stuff. The brain is an electrical entity. It's an electrical entity. These are electrical entities all around us, stimulating our brain. Research has been done on this about that, and it's continuing to be done. So, it's something we need to pay attention to. Media bombardment, something we need to pay attention to. How long did that presidential campaign last? How much effect did it have on us, on our psyches, on our calmness, on our ability just to return to this joy? 2 years we did this. 2 years. Every longer and longer and longer. So we need to pay attention. We need to pay attention and sometimes withdraw a little bit from this stuff. We don't live in a monastic setting. We're not doing zazen in a monastic setting. We're doing it in an urban setting. So in the 21st century, a study was done in Norway about 15 years ago in which the small town, well, not small town, town of 200,000 people in Norway, during this time of the study, they agreed that the media would only do positive things for 6 months. this couldn't be done now, but this was before, you know, global. Maybe it was more like 20 years ago. So that for 6 months, and they did some kind of little test of people's happiness level beginning of the 6 months and at the end of the 6 months of only positive media, and there was quite a difference, quite a difference. Studies have been done just this last year on video games, which I read about. Video games. And people who play video games. Yesterday I was out biking and I stopped to have a latte. And there was a family in playing a video game. Well, I was also reading the paper, so I stayed probably for an hour. This family was playing the video game the whole time. And it reminded me of the study. The study shows that people who've been playing video games a lot regularly for long periods of time, if you test their brain activity right after playing, only left brain, no right brain, only left brain. Where's the joy? The joy is in right brain. The left brain is good about planning, good about remembering, good about comparing, good about competing, good about challenging, good about getting along in a fast-paced society. No right brain activity after continual practicing of video games, if you call it a practice. I don't know. Whatever you call it. And then they follow-up studies for several days later, still no activity, dead. Right brain dead. I mean, of course, it comes back to life. But so this is significant. We have significant challenges to our Buddhist practice, to our zazen, to our meditation. But they had significant challenges too. They were just different. Production, everything measured. We are a measuring society. We measure everything. If we're laying bricks, the number of bricks you lay in an hour, your boss is out there clocking you. If you're an attorney, my daughter-in-law is an attorney. She's got to bill her bathroom time. She has to bill her bathroom time, billable hours. It's all on billable hours, right? Imagine having to bill your bathroom time and then be evaluated. How does that make you feel? How does that do for your practice? I don't mean your Zen practice here. I mean your practice of just returning to being with this. So it's a challenge. It conceals, when we get caught by it, our original joy, our original stillness. Social isolation. Americans, we're individualists. We think that our families are dysfunctional. We think our spiritual communities are dysfunctional. We think our jobs are our job communities are dysfunctional. Everything is dysfunctional. We're individuals. But you have to have sangha. You have to have community. And if everything is dysfunctional, then maybe we should erase the word dysfunctional. What does the word dysfunctional mean? If our families, if our churches, if our jobs are dysfunctional, it's a term that I think has no relevance, and you should just cut it out, and deal with this situation. That if we work together, we get support, and if we get support, it helps us feel connected. Pretty simple. Pretty simple. Rumi says, be kind. Everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Studies of depression. The lowest incidence of depression in the United States is what? Among Amish people. And the second, a tribe in New Guinea. Both of these groups are really focused on the group, on the support system all around. You can say it's dysfunctional if you want. They have almost no depression. So creating community. We call that sangha in Buddhism. And then when people think about sangha, they think about something idyllic. It's not idyllic, but it helps. It helps. Another, because we're so fast-paced, we have I'm a psychologist, you know, in the DSM-4, the Diagnostic Manual 4, we've got one of our diagnostic categories is what I would call extended grieving. Extended grieving is considered dysfunctional because we don't have time for extended grieving in this culture. Get it over with. Do it. Yes, you need to grieve, but you can do it in 3 hours or 3 days if you really do it. But what was it like for our grandparents? I mean, my grandmother used to talk about her mother. She wore black for 10 years after she lost her husband. And you could say, oh, she was just forced to do that. My grandmother said, no, it helped her because it helped her grieve. It helped her deal with her sadness, with how much she missed the person. And society acknowledged that and didn't expect so much in my great-grandmother because that was part of the process, part of the culture. So it's something else that we conceal. We don't allow ourselves time to grieve. We've lost a lot, each of us, in terms of relationships, in terms of love, in terms of people, allowing us time to grieve. Nutrition. I don't know how many of you have food sensitivities. How many of you had food sensitivities? Maybe you don't want to raise your hands, but food sensitivities, more allergies and more food sensitivities than ever before, partly because we have a monoculture, mono-agriculture. Wheat food sensitivity, really problematic, because we've got it down now so that there's only one strain of wheat that's grown in the United States. There are like, 50 or 100 varieties of wheat, and there's one, Durum wheat. And so no wonder, if you don't have a variety, no wonder. So we end up taking a lot of vitamins. I mean, I'm, through my kinesiologist, I probably take 8 things, fish oil, vitamin this, vitamin that, every morning and every night. That's fine, but it's something we need to pay attention to. Because if we have stomach aches, we can't do zazen. We don't feel joyful if we don't have energy. If you just sit during retreat with a stomach ache, because it's not really a retreat. It's not really a treat. It's just, I don't know, austere, kind of a practice in self-flagellation, really. And finally, it's a consuming culture. Buddha said that the dissatisfaction is based on 2 things, right? Well, I've talked about a lot before, not getting what we want. That's dissatisfaction. But our society is built on getting what we want, on grabbing at what we want, on figuring out how to get it more and more and more. So the value, the core value of a consumer culture is really, really almost in contradiction to the core value of a Buddhist culture, which in Buddhist culture we don't deny ourselves, but we notice our grabbing, we notice our grasping, and we don't create a society which encourages that, which says that that's the way to be. We just say, oh, this is a problem for human beings. Finally, and this is the one that has affected me, and that I've just realized probably. Well, my wife is telling me it for years, but I just acknowledged it last year, getting enough sleep. 1900, how much sleep did the average person get a night? Have you read this? 8 to 9 hours. 8 to 9 hours. Right now, the average person gets 6 to 7 hours. So the average person in our culture gets 2 hours less sleep than they did in 1900. Do you think that's going to help us settle into our original joy, to be tired all the time, to be just on the edge all the time? But we got sped up. We got sped up. We didn't need sleep. And I always said to Linda, I don't need sleep. I said, you know, my meditation is better than sleep. I'm completely still. She said, yeah, right. She was right. She was right. Right. So life's not more stressful than it was for Katagiri Roshi, Suzuki Roshi, Dogen, Buddha. It's stressful in a different way. And we need to take care of the unique stressors in our environment that really smother our just basic happiness, our basic joy. I mean, they had to deal with what? They had to deal with starvation. Katagiri Roshi used to talk about cooking weeds. They had no food. He'd go out and he'd pick weeds. They cooked them. I mean, you know, we don't have to deal with that. We don't have that. Dogen lived in a time of war in his country, warring Buddhist camps, warring with each other, violence all around him. Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi lived in World War II. In their country, there was huge fighting going on. We don't have war in our country. In my lifetime, 65 years, we've had no war. So they had their own stressors, right? They dealt with them. We just need to deal with them. We just need to deal with them. And we need downtime to weather stress. In those cultures, they had the downtime built in. And, of course, for people like Katagiri and Suzuki and Dogen, it was zazen. I mean, everybody did it. if you were a monk, you just did zazen. I mean, it wasn't like, I'll get up this morning, but maybe I'll switch and not do it in the morning. I'll do it in the afternoon. Or maybe I can try it just after lunch. No, you just did it. It was downtime. And whether you do zazen or not, you need to do something. If you're going to just come back to your being with this and letting your joy come up, just letting it come up. So those are some external stressors and how we look at them and maybe how we deal with them. Internal stressors. Well, the internal stressors have always been the same since the time of Buddha. And I talk about them all the time. And basically, there are two. That we feel separate from the world and that our thoughts run rampant. We feel separate from the world and our thoughts run rampant. And the more separate we feel, the more rampant our thoughts, the more our thoughts get revved up. And when we feel really separate, we're just running in our mind, just running and running. When we feel closer to someone, when we feel close to something, whether it be a human being or a flower or someone's pain, our mind just naturally calms down. Naturally calms down. So those are the internal stressors. So there's a story about Rodin and Rilke. Rilke was German, Rodin was French, but Rilke went to Paris. Maybe some of you know this story. Rilke went to Paris, and Rilke had a horrible depression. If you read his poetry, you may not know. He seems like a great mystic. Some great mystics had horrible depression. I mean, don't try to put people in boxes. He had horrible depression, and he also was a great enlightened sage in much of his writing. So Rilke was in Paris, and he and Rodin became friends, and his depression was really bad. And he went to see Rodin, and Rodin said to him, "Go to the zoo every day and just watch the animals." Well, you know, they had no psychiatrist, they had no meds, they didn't know anything about zazen. But Rodin was not stupid. He said to Rilke, "Go to the zoo every day and just watch. Just watch." So what happened? Rilke went to the zoo every day and he just watched. And after that, he felt much better. He was able to really start doing his poetry again. His poetry was coming up again. So come into the zendo. Sit down and just watch the zoo. Just watch the zoo. Just watch it. It's quite wonderful, you know. It's nothing to get all upset about. And also, we can work on practicing changing our thinking. I talk about this quite a bit. We can change our thinking. We can remind ourselves that it's our nature to be resilient, to be happy, to be open. We can remind ourselves. We need to remind ourselves. Years ago, when I was practicing in San Francisco, in the winter, it was hard for me to practice because it's cold in San Francisco in the winter. We'd sometimes get below 50 degrees, really cold. I mean, it seemed really cold to me, and foggy, foggy. Of course, I'd never been to Minnesota then. Cold and foggy. And then this time of the year, it's getting up in the middle of the night to do zazen. It was getting up in the middle of the night, and I would go out the door, and I would get my young girlfriend to come with me. She did that in those days. She quit doing that 35 years ago, but she did that in those days. And And we would go, and we would sit. And, you know, we would same time as we sit here, 5:45 in the morning. It was hard. It was difficult. And I had to remind myself. I had to remind myself. Because often I would just feel like a zombie. Or a zombie walking over, or a zombie sitting, a zombie going home, and saying to Linda, geez, I just want to go back to bed. After, you know, by then it's, you know, 7:30. But I had to go to work. So I had to remind myself. And it was not, sometimes it's not fun. Sometimes doing a meditation practice regularly is not fun. Sometimes trying to play a musical instrument when it doesn't work is not fun. Sometimes doing many, many things, it's not fun. But if you commit yourself, then you commit yourself. And one morning we didn't have cars in San Francisco, and walking home after one of these zombie-like zazens, where I thought, God, I am just dead. I'm just a dead man walking. Why am I doing this? I looked down at the pavement and I saw these little sprouts of weeds growing up through the pavement, through the nicely cemented pavement. This life, this green life just coming up and just breaking through the pavement. And it just helped me a little bit. I just looked at it and I felt kind of alive. And I went home and I pulled open my book of Zen poetry, and I wrote down by my alarm clock, right on top of my alarm clock, the poem, sitting quietly, doing nothing, spring comes and the grass grows by itself. So actually I put it right next to the turn-off part of my alarm. And it helped. It helped. I don't know how long it helped for. Enough to get me through that winter. So another kind of thinking that we should remember is that we're never too old or too depressed to do this practice. That the mind is resilient. There have been studies on neuroplasticity being done by brain anatomists. Neuroplasticity, how fluid the brain is. Every 6 to 12 months, all the cells in the brain are replaced. And what they're recommending for people of an advanced age like me is what? That we take up new activities. That if we take up new activities, we can extend our longevity by 10 to 20 years. Because our brains are so, there's so much plasticity, so much fluidity in our brains, that we can reconnect, make new connections at any point. And that our cells are always dying, so they can always be replaced. Another thing that we do in regard to internal is the practice of meditation is dislodging thoughts from our bodies. Many of you heard Ken MacLeod last week. That was what he was focusing on, how thoughts get lodged in our bodies in terms of they get lodged in a feeling kind of way in our bodies. And Zazen is partly, whenever it comes up, it's experiencing that feeling, experiencing where it's lodged, how it's moving, how dense it is, until it unlodges itself, because it does. And then reminding ourselves, again, this is a la Kent MacLeod from last week, reminding ourselves that we are many selves. We are many selves. Rumi says, "Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond." So we're many selves. we can honor the multiplicity of selves that are all coming up. And we don't need to just think, this is the right self. This is the actual self. This is the real self. As long as we do that, we're not experiencing the joy of just being here, because we're trying to do the good self, or the something, the accomplishing self, or maybe the stilling the mind self. Rumi also says, half of any person is wrong and weak and off the beaten path. Half. The other half is dancing and swimming and laughing in invisible joy. The other half. So, Lincoln. Some of you guys know about Lincoln, right? Lincoln. One of Lincoln's multiplicity of selves was what? Depressed. Deep depression. Deep melancholy. Right? He's considered our greatest president. Why is he considered our greatest president? Because he drew on the multiplicity of selves. He drew on his statesman self. He drew on his self that meant that after he became president, he brought all his rivals together and put them in key places of power. Just as some people are wondering if Obama is going to be doing. And he didn't just do it. He did it and then he listened to them. So that's his resilient self. His resilient self. But he had to train himself. This is training. This is practice that we're doing. He had to train himself. There's one commentator on Lincoln talks about how Lincoln came into a diner one evening, and he was sitting by himself at the diner, and the person who wrote about him said, this man looked like he had seen the end of the world. He was so woebegone. He was so down. He was so he looked so hopeless in his countenance. He was so slumped over. And this person also wrote that then a bunch of people came into the diner. And a half an hour later, Lincoln was over with those people telling stories. And everybody was laughing. And Lincoln's long legs were spread out. As he told stories, everybody was around him laughing. So we have this resiliency, this ability to work with this multiplicity of selves, to play with this multiplicity of selves. And finally, we have this ability to open our hearts in our watching. Whether we're watching the zoo animals, or whether we're watching our thinking, or whether we're watching whatever, just to open our hearts. We close our hearts down to protect ourselves because we've been hurt. We've been hurt. We've been damaged. People have damaged us. No wonder we withdraw. No wonder we feel separate. It's a cruel world out there. We've been damaged. Pema Chodron has a quote. She says the heart is a sea anemone. When you get close to it, it closes to protect its softness. So this is a defense mechanism to close our heart, to protect the softness that's inside. That softness is always there, and sometimes we have to close and protect it. But in a way, the act of meditation is learning how to open our hearts just to whatever comes up. Without forcing it, without shooting it, without comparing it, just little by little. And then we know how to close down again. We always need to know how to close down, because we have to protect that softness. So basically, I think that's what I want to say today. Slow down. Just slow down. You don't have to, You don't have to develop a kind of a big technique for slowing down. Well, maybe you do. Maybe you have to organize. Some people have to develop a technique to slow down. Maybe you really need to organize your life so you can slow down. Hang out with other people. Hang out with others. Create Sangha. If this Sangha is a Sangha for you, then work with it. If not, create another one. But don't look for the functional Sangha. Instead, work with a dysfunctional Sangha, and you'll see that it helps you. It supports you. It becomes, you build community. You create community. Everybody wants a different family. You know, they want some other family. But then you learn about that other family. You've been with that other family for a while, and is it any better? Is it any better? Is it any different? And don't get too caught by consumer culture. And capitalism is fine, you know. I'm always been interested in entrepreneurial stuff. I've never done it because I was kind of too into Buddhism, but it always kind of appealed to me. But just be careful. Just be careful, and don't get totally wasted by it. It'll waste you. And do fun things. If you do fun things, then the joy is there. Do fun stuff. Watch comedies. If you're going to watch TV at all, if you're going to watch DVD, do Laurel and Hardy. Or whatever. Laurel and Hardy is my favorite because I'm old, right? But you can be young and still like Laurel and Hardy. Somebody was saying to me a while ago, maybe it was Monica, that Zen is Buddhism with jokes. Not you? Oh, somebody was. That's right. Zen is Buddhism with jokes. With jokes. And do zazen. Do meditation. Do retreats. We have retreats going on every month so that you can retreat to just being still, to just slowing down. And we have, I'm trying to make the retreat. There's another thing that I even forgot to mention that we don't do in the 21st century is we don't work with our bodies. In 1900, 90% of the population made their living with their bodies. 90% of the population. In the Zen monasteries of old, they worked, they did manual labor 3 to 4 hours a day, starting from Baijiang in the 8th century, 3 to 4 hours a day, because they knew that working with your body, that you're doing things with your body, is a way to connect, is a way to feel part of, as a way, ultimately, to feel joyful. So, in our retreats, I'm trying to make sure that we don't just sit still, that we have walking meditation, that we have manual labor, and for our long retreat, our one coming up in December, we'll also have either yoga or qigong, just so we can be in our bodies, be with our bodies, doing stuff. It's our natural way to be as human beings. It's where the natural joy comes from. So I want to finish with poem that Ken MacLeod gave last Saturday. I just changed it a little bit because one of his words I changed because I like mine better. Joy. May I enjoy the activities of life itself. May I enjoy things just as they are. May I experience the world taking joy in all that I do. May I fully respond to whatever arises. So maybe you can tape that on your lamp or something. It's good to tape something on your whatever it is, just to help you, just to help you. So I think that's what I've got on my mind for this morning. So
what word you changed?
What'd you say?
What word you changed?
Oh, I changed. Oh, I left his. I don't remember what he. I don't remember what his was. It was something. I don't remember. It's the last phrase. I said, "May I fully respond to whatever arises." He said, "May I?" Oh, and something that sounded like work to me, so I changed it. I don't know what he said. Maybe he said, "May I cultivate?" I have to go back and look at it. So he gave us his sheets. "May I cultivate that which arises?" Well, you don't have to cultivate anything. We're always cultivating stuff.
I have a question.
Sure.
I'm curious about this. When you were talking about the Buddhist experience when he was 9 or 10 years old.
Yep.
I'm wondering how many other people have had a similar sort of thing. Because I know for me, about that age, I have a distinct memory of playing in a sandbox with my brother and some of the neighborhood kids. I was kind of socially slow, so at 7 or 8 or 9, I was still playing in the sandbox. But there was a moment that struck me, and I remember thinking, this has all happened before.
Mm.
And it stayed with me for, I don't know, 3 or 4 minutes, and I was just stunned.
Mm.
And I asked my brother and my friends, hasn't this all happened before? Said, well, no, I don't think so. But I think it was the same kind of thing. It was something stopped and just kind of connected. But I'm wondering how many other people have had, I don't know, similar moments. I mean, it's called deja vu, that particular variety. But
I think everybody has some experience of that sort of quiet in the real world that comes as a shock.
We
all have epiphanies all the time.
Thanks. Bill.
You said about the working 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah.
That was really wasn't it. I mean, it happens if you get to connect, but it wasn't a choice.
Well, it was.
It wasn't a choice to work 4 hours a day.
What do you mean it wasn't a choice?
Well, I think you would have no choice but to work that if you're going to survive.
To survive? The monasteries. Baijiang was the guy who developed it. It was part of Baijiang's rule. At that time, the monasteries were totally dependent on the lay people. And for hundreds of years, Buddhists didn't work. And it's considered an honor for a lay person to donate to the Buddhist monks. Baijiang changed that. And did he change that because he thought, well, they better contribute to society? Or did he change that because he thought, well, they weren't getting enough from the lay people? Or did he do that because he really felt that work and doing something in your body is a way to be in the world and to manifest joy? Baijiang loved working. He loved working with his tools. You know these stories about Baijiang that it was one of his favorite things, just as much as doing zazen. And he felt that the natural joy of life is present in manifesting that. And you know the story that when Baijiang was very old, they took his tools away because they said, he's too old. He should rest. He's our teacher. He's 83. It's time for him to rest. And he refused to come to the meal. Of course, this was their practice. And then he said, a day without working is a day without eating. But it wasn't a should for him. It was like a manifestation of the Buddha nature, of the still nature. And to leave that out, he thought, was not to be alive in the monastery. So
is that working unique to Zen monastery?
It was. It happens at the birth of Zen. Or maybe not the birth. It seems to happen with Baijiang, which is maybe it's when Baijiang develops the first code of behavior for Zen, and also it includes manual labor. But I'm sure it also has some political. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so there are multiplicity of reasons for it. Bajang was not dumb. You know. And then so in China, work became very, very important for them in the monasteries. Then the monasteries got really rich. And the reason Buddhism, many people think the reason Buddhism didn't really survive in China was that the monks stopped doing so much labor. They got rich. The Buddha, they got establishment rich. And so the communists just came in and mashed them because they were just potentates. So that always seems to happen, doesn't it? What else this morning, you guys?
Jeff. Something I was thinking about this morning, actually. So one of the Four Noble Truths is that there's cessation of suffering. The cessation of the Eightfold Noble Path.
Mm-hmm.
But, so what would you think of the idea of there's cessation, the cessation of suffering, and it keeps going, and you have to kind of keep going with it? Because I don't, for some reason, maybe it's just our language, but the idea of cessation of suffering, I don't, that doesn't click at this moment.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. We there, from a Zen point of view, there's always suffering in our lives.
There's always joy.
And there's always joy, and there's always going to be dissatisfaction. So in Zen, we say the suffering is always here. But dissatisfaction really does get minimized through this practice so that we're able just to be where we are with whatever suffering comes up. But 100%? No, I'm not 100%. As soon as you say 100%, you've got some new ideal out there that's a creation of your head that you're going to try to live up to. And good luck. Good luck. Your heart's closed down as soon as you say 100% everything, anything, about anything. Because then you've got this out here, and the anemone just shuts down, thinking, geez, it's 100%, I don't have to open.
Maybe it just calls for more flexible language or something.
Well, in Zen, of course, we have lots of flexible language. So we say that really, you know, it's not a path from here to there. It's a path from there to here. and there's no there and no here and all that stuff in Zen. So but it's true that in early Buddhism it was very linear, very much here's the samsaric world here and there's the nirvanic world and I'm gradually progressing and I will in this lifetime or 32 lifetimes from now experience joy. The joy of nirvana, right? And on the way, I'll experience incremental joys, but I won't settle into just the stillness of the Buddha nature. It's not till Mahayana comes up that they say, oh, this joy is always here. Always here. It's your nature. Anything else? Thank you.